I don't know how to say any of this. Dave Lewis was supposed to be here shortly after I got to the local area. I get emails saying, bad news, I'm not coming. Would you give my presentation for me? So I thought about it. Now, his is Living a Whole World of Music, the Henry Cowell collection. There's the famous quote of him living in the whole world of music. I happen to have been the archivist for the Henry Cowell collection for a year and a half at NYPL. So I lived in the whole world of Henry Cowell. And it was a really transformative experience. So I've agreed to do it. Now, there's a PowerPoint which you will not see, which I hope you're not too disappointed. I don't particularly love PowerPoints anyhow. I will read this. There's audio, which I'm not sure what they are precisely. I have cues to play them, and we'll go through this if you bear with me. Living in a Whole World of Music, the Henry Cowell Collection by Uncle Dave Lewis.
Mr. Henry Cowell's first compositions were for the piano. These weren't ordinary piano pieces by any means.
My name is Henry Cowell.
Okay. By the way, I'm yelling, so I hope you can hear me. If not, let me know. I would like to thank the following individuals and institutions for assisting with this presentation: Sarah Velez, Tom Christie, and George Boswick of NYPL. A special thanks to Peter Hirsch of NYPL for agreeing to deliver this talk in my absence. Joel Sachs and Cheryl Seltzer of the New Music Ensemble Continuum, Richard Teitelbaum and Hiroko Sakurazawa of the Estate of Henry Cowell, Keith Larson of the University of Michigan, Stuart Manville of the Granger Museum, Smithsonian Institution, Margaret Lang Tan, Brian Brandt of Mode Records, Charles Amerkanian and Adrienne Cardwell of the Other Minds Foundation, Paul Tai of New World Records, Peggy and Mike Seeger, Patrick Feaster and Brendan Nelson Strauss of IU and of ARS and Stanford University, and my family, or his family. Very sorry that I cannot be with you at this time. The reasons for my non-attendance are manifold, and they only came to a head shortly before the conference. Believe me, it's true. I hope that you will forgive me in the humble effort which follows. Early history. I suspect if you are here, you might know at least that Henry Cowell was a pianist and composer of some significance and may have encountered some of the albums that he edited for the Ethnic Folkways label. The album of piano solos Henry Cowell recorded for Folkways in 1963 dominates the landscape of his own recorded efforts to such extent that Wikipedia refers to it as his sole album. My interest in documenting Cowell's recordings initially came about as I wondered how a concert artist who was active from 1912 to about 1964 could get away with making only one recording. I knew this was untrue, as I was aware of an earlier half album for CRI and had vague memories of having heard Cowell on some school record I listened to in the third grade. I wanted to investigate the extent of his recorded pianism and how many earlier recordings Cowell made as pianist. While the Folkways album is, in a way, definitive, Cowell himself rather ruefully admits in his spoken commentary that his pianism wasn't, at the time, quite up to his own preferred standard.
This rises to a pitch so that in the final variation, both of my forearms play every tone that could possibly reach in the chromatic scale, all at the same time and as loudly as possible. And it was about this that the London Times, which is always right, said that this was the world's loudest piano music and that I was the world's loudest pianist. But of course that was a long years ago, and I don't suppose I am now.
So there. Henry Cowell was born in Menlo Park, California, literally the town next door to Palo Alto, on March 11, 1897. His parents are often described as a classic bohemian California couple. His father, Harry Cowell, was an Irish actor and singer, and his mother, Clarissa Dixon, was a feminist author. His parents divorced when Henry was only 5, and though raised by his mother, Cowell effectively had access to both parents. Henry Cowell was the subject of a Stanford University study in 1911, and he had apparently learned how to read and write music somewhat before he learned to read and write English. Cowell was suffering from a severe form of learning disability and failing all his courses, and yet demonstrated an aptitude for music well beyond his years. The Stanford researchers declined to comment as to whether they believed Cowell in his assertion that the noisy piano music that he played was going to revolutionize music, something Henry was already telling them in 1911. Around this time, Cowell coined the term tone cluster to describe his use of long strings of adjacent tones at the piano.
When I was 14, I was asked to write music for a play based on an old Irish story of Manannan. Manannan was the god of the tides of the sea, actually the god of all motion. The play began with his home on the sea, and I was to give the musical idea of what his home was like. So I started this way. This seemed sort of a nice rhythm, but it wasn't quite deep enough and mysterious enough. I thought maybe a chord would be better, so I tried a chord. It sounded like this. Well, that seemed quite a lot better, but it still didn't seem mysterious enough or quite rich enough. So then I thought of the idea of having all the notes of an octave. I played them in the same rhythm. It sounded like this. I liked that a lot better. But of course, I didn't have 13 fingers on my left hand, so I had to use the flat of my hand in order to play all of these tones. As I developed my idea, I wanted the music to get louder. What to do? I thought maybe I should use all of the tones in 2 octaves. Here's how that sounded. This was just the thing I wanted, except that if I used 2 hands to do that, I wouldn't have a hand free for playing the rest of the music. Then I taught myself to play this cluster of tones with my forearm. It sounded the same as when I used 2 hands, and this gave me a free hand to play something else.
There's more.
I call these groups of tones tone clusters. You can't harm a piano by playing tone clusters. A lot of keys may be played at the same time, even using your forearm if you do it correctly. I never strike or attack the keys, I simply press them.
Henry Cowell, one person who took an interest in Cowell early on was composer and musicologist Charles Seeger, a local name, who accepted Cowell as a student at UC Berkeley in 1913. Seeger is perhaps best known as father to one of America's greatest musical dynasties, Pete, Mike, Peggy, and Barbara Seeger, all of whom have made impressive contributions to American music in the field of traditional music as performers, scholars, in education, and as composers. Seeger's exhaustive study on the folk song Barbara Allen in the 1930s set new standards for examining the relationship between European folk forms and their American counterparts. In 1914, however, Seeger was conducting pioneering research into revolutionary and radical techniques as applied to modern music, which Cowell soaked up like a sponge. Cowell adopted some of his key technical resources, including advanced polyrhythm, his interest in the harmonic parcels of the overtone series, dissonant counterpoint, and the like, from Seeger, who additionally suggested to Cowell that he develop a theoretical basis for his own discoveries. This would bear fruit somewhat later. Another contact that Cowell made early on that would prove quite important to him was with John Varian, the theosophist, playwright and poet who headed another American dynasty, whose work and legacy would prove of critical importance to the history of the institution where this talk is being given, Stanford University. By 1917, Cowell was acting as Varian's music master and composed incidental music to Varian's play, The Building of Bamba, which Cowell often referred to as an Irish mythological opera. It wasn't really an opera, more like a pageant, but it was important work for Cowell as he incorporated the already existing tides of into its text, in addition to tides of Manaunan, I believe he left that, into its text, in addition to composing other pieces for Varian that would form part of his permanent piano repertoire. Section 3, The Cowell Circle. After a stint with the American Army during World War I, I believe he played clarinet, Cowell began his concert career in earnest, traveling worldwide to play his own music and participating in the Pro Musica Society of New York, which brought him into contact with a wide range of American composers of an experimental bent, including Edgard Varèse, Dane Rudyard, Ruth Crawford, who later married Charles Seeger, Charles Ives, Carl Ruggles, and many others. As there are many, many others. In 1927, Cowell founded the periodical New Music in San Francisco, which through 1955 was the main American publication devoted solely to providing exposure to new compositions in an experimental style. Many pieces that are considered classics of the early American avant-garde first appeared in print in New Music, which made its bow with the orchestral score of Ruggles' Men in Mountains. Subsequently, some two-thirds of the subscriptions were returned for the first issue, but with the financial help of Charles Ives and Cowell's cautious management and connections, the publication continued for decades, operating on a shoestring. Among other important publications that Cowell invested his energy at this time was the book New Musical Resources, the result of Seeger's suggestion that Cowell develop a theoretical basis for his work. This book is still used by composers today as a key theoretical text and a source for ideas. Another book edited by Cowell, American Composers on American Music, was published in 1933 by Stanford University Press. The table of contents reveals articles about practically everyone in Cowell's circle, almost all the American avant-garde composers active at this time. In reference to this volume, Cowell commented in 1962 that, quote, I reread the book for the first time in nearly 30 years and was pleasantly surprised that I seem to have placed my bets well, since so many of today's major figures in American music have found a place in the volume then, had found a place. Section 4, Cowell at the piano. Before we get into Cowell's work at the New School, which brought him into contact with recordings firsthand, it seems sensible to address my question about his piano recordings. As by 1930, Cowell had composed all of the piano music that he commonly played in his concert appearances and in recordings. Pianist Margaret Nicklorick made a Velta role of Cowell's The Ties Manaunau in 1926, and the Cowell is said to have cut one. Cowell is said to have cut himself one for Pleyel in Paris, though, if so, is not known to have survived. Cowell's earliest extant piano solos were recorded onto Fairchild-type instantaneous-cut uncoated aluminums at the New School around 1933, and a series of improvisations were recorded on the same equipment somewhat later. These are at NYPL and contain hilarious examples of Cowell making up songs, nonsense words, and music at the piano, and an improvisation or two, where he's joined by a violin player, and what I describe in my NYPL notes as percussion, or perhaps someone whacking the hell out of a music stand. In early 1934, Cowell made his studio recording debut as the tone cluster pianist on the Columbia record of Edgard Varèse's Ionization. I think that's what we just heard, although I can't say for sure. But I see people nodding their heads. Good. That was not somebody banging on a music stand, apparently. However, Cowell's first solo piano session in the studio didn't take place until March 19, 1941, when Cowell recorded 12 selections in the recording studio run by composer Joseph Schillinger. These are also in NYPL. I have no examples to play you today, but having heard them, I can attest that these are the best recordings of Cowell in terms of transmitting the force and power of his playing and the sense of virtuosity, both in terms of transcendental technique and his sense of touch displayed by the youthful Cowell. Although he contributed 3 solos to a concert hall society set entitled American Composers at the Piano, I think that's on red vinyl, I've seen a copy of that, in 1949. The next album-length Cowell session wasn't until a decade later, on October 8, 1951, when Cowell recorded at least 6 solos and 2 tracks of commentary for Circle Records, a small company run by author and critic Rudy Blesch. Cowell's Circle Records are very obscure, though WorldCat lists 36 entries for it. Practically all of these are linked to copies of the Folkways album. One entry is linked only to the 6 3/4-inch disc of Cowell's commentary that was included along with the LP in 78 RPM set versions. His 1999 discography and the first reasonably comprehensive one for Cowell, the late composer and Fluxus artist Dick Higgins, seems to conclude that the content for the Circle and Folkways albums are the same, as is the recordings. But this doesn't make a lot of sense. Broadcast recordings from around 1951 that I've heard reveal Cowell's voice was not as frail as it is on the Folkways album. And as the Circle release was probably a 10-inch LP in 78 set, the 21 selections on the Folkways album seems like a lot for these formats to accommodate. It's more plausible that if the Circle recording was reissued, that a CRI album issued in 1956, along with the works of Pinkham and Havanas, is the most likely suspect. I was not, however, able to resolve this issue in time for the talk. And for the moment, the content of the Circle album remains something of a mystery. After the release of the Folkways album in 1963, one further brace of Cowell solos was issued as part of an educational set created by Silver Burdett, then the educational arm of Time magazine, as recorded by the Special Products Divisions of CBS Records. The 6 LP volumes in Making Music Your Own were designed for use by teachers at the elementary level, and finding copies of the LPs in libraries today can be rather difficult, as many were ultimately discarded as outdated teaching material. In most libraries, the album sets are also filed separately from the books. I can see why my third grade teacher didn't like to use these sets. They're difficult to get apart, and once inside, we see a bewildering alphabet soup and color code combination that is used to combine tracks with the books. However, way at the bottom right hand of the listing, we encountered a series called Listen to the Composer, which includes profiles of Aaron Copland, Henry Cowell, Otto Luening, who served on the advisory board of this project, and Norman De La Gioia. The Copeland music is sourced from recordings CBS already had on file, but not the Cowell, as his music tracks and narration were recorded anew in excellent sound. Although a precise date for Cowell's performances for Making Music Your Own is not yet known, they might be later than those on the Folkways recording. And although condensed, this set contains one of his best recordings of the band, She.
I wonder if you know what a banshee is. The people of Ireland do, and many of them will tell you that they have heard a banshee. She's like a ghost. She wails and screams and moves about in a very scary way. At first, I just moved my hands across the strings with a sweeping motion. Then I pinched a string between two fingers and ran these fingers down the length of the string. I'm sure you can tell what I'm doing, and the music sounds like this. I was sweeping one hand over the strings and plucking certain strings with the other hand. When you hear the banshee another time, I am sure you will recognize all these ways I play on the strings.
The Folkways album is a coherent unit, both as a creative effort and in a historic sense. However, there are many reasons why a collected edition of Cowell's other recordings as a pianist would be highly desirable. But get through the rest of this in time. New School and New Music. In 1928, Cowell was first tapped to teach at the New School for Social Research, an institution that exists today, but its music department is now Manus School for Music. From the beginning, Cowell's course in ethnomusicology, one of the first of its kind given in America, was entitled Music of the World's People, or Music of the World's Peoples. To further his resources in 1930, Cowell went to the Berlin Phonogram Archive to study with Eric Hornbostel, then considered a top generalist in the field of ethnomusicology. Now there's video, but you won't see it. The archive, founded in 1902 by Carl Stumpf, by 1930 it amassed 16,000 cylinders of world music collected by musicologists in the field, some of which went back to before the turn of the 20th century. Cowell returned to Berlin in 1931 with the authority to purchase a demonstration collection of various samples from the archive on behalf of the New School, comprising 120 cylinders, about 4 hours of music from Hornbostel. The archive used a special system of galvanos to make limited amounts of copies of wax cylinders in the collection that Hornbostel selected. What follows is a short montage provides a hint of what attending Cowell's class may have been like in the early 1930s. Now, I only have one more sound file. It doesn't seem to match what he said, so I'm going to play it and see if it's the Hornbostel material or not. If it isn't, it'll be interesting. This doesn't sound like a wax cylinder to me. Well, I'll let it play out. We can play guess, drop the needle. Okay. My guess is this is material he collected later. I know he traveled a lot. Do you know Seth? This was stuff he collected much later. It's obviously not wax cylinders. And
these don't sound like they're from his personal collection. Yeah. There was also a bunch of recordings done at the New School in 1930 with Percy Grainger and a whole bunch of instrumentalists.
Oh, there's a ton of stuff. I mean, that could be easily another paper. I'll plow through this. That's actually the last clip that he sent, although there's indications there should be more. Among the students in Cowell's classes of this time were aspiring composers Lou Harrison and John Cage. Cage also worked as a teaching assistant to Cowell in the Music of the World's Peoples course, and Harrison recorded Japanese flute solos for use in Cowell's classes in 1941. Harrison's disc resides in the NYPL collection. 1932 or early 1933, the New School obtained a disc cutter, and Cowell recorded another demonstration collection from Native American ethnologist Helen Roberts. Also 120 cylinders, onto uncoated aluminum discs for use in the New School. Both this collection and the Hornbostel material were donated by Cowell and the New School to the Archive of Folk Song at Indiana University. The Berlin Phonogram Archive collection disappeared into the hands of the Soviets during World War II and has since resurfaced and been repatriated. However, in the time that it was considered lost, the Cowell copy was combined with one other to make up Folkways LP release of material from the collection prepared by Indiana University in 1963. In 1930, the staff of the New School was joined by composer Percy Grainger. On the strength of a sensational series of lectures given by Grainger in New York that year. About 1933, Grainger produced an educational label called Grainger New School Recordings, utilizing the cutter at the New School. According to the Grainger Museum in White Plains, curator Stuart Manville, these recordings were designed to represent the lectures he had given in 1930, and indeed part of the fun and experience in them now is listening to Grainger speak. Cowell was certainly involved in this project, possibly as an engineer. His complete set of the recordings were the ones preserved by Seth Winner onto tape in 1996. However, they are not entirely successful technically and deteriorate badly towards the ends of the sides. Such experience may have convinced Cowell to utilize professional studios when he decided to start the New Music Quarterly recording series in 1934. NMQR was the recording arm of the New Music publications. The records were received by subscribers four times a year through about 1940 and were also sold through the Gramophone Shop in New York. It was the first American label devoted exclusively to what was then considered ultra-modern classical compositions, and Cowell began the label with less than $500. Although, as we shall see, Cowell did not act in an executive capacity for NMQR's entire run, from its debut with a recording of the Adagio from Ruth Crawford Seeger's String Quartet, 1931, to its final release in 1949, it issued 30 records, containing the first recordings of works by composers such as Charles Ives, Carl Ruggles, George Antheil, and Otto Luening. NYPL holds a number of recordings that were made as tests or rehearsals of early NMQR projects, including one of two works composed by William Russell entitled Invocation to Ezuli and Congo Dance. Neither of these titles nor the works themselves show any correspondence with the established canon of 12 pieces composed by Russell for percussion ensemble. There's supposed to be audio, but there isn't. Cowell in prison. Cowell's industriousness by 1936 was impressive. He was composing, teaching, and keeping both a periodical and record company based in essentially non-commercial music afloat in the Great Depression. However, all of this came to an end that year as Henry Cowell was arrested, charged, and convicted of compromising the morals of a minor and sent to San Quentin prison to serve a 15-year sentence. Cowell was not guilty of the charge, and his conviction led to a nationwide effort among American musicians to gain Cowell's release. Yeah, there was an effort. I won't comment. Spearheading the effort was conductor Leopold Stokowski, who certainly was investing his energy in a cause that would reap him some dividends, as Cowell would compose some of his finest works for Stokowski, including the Hymn and Fuguing Tune No. 2 in Persian Set. I don't know how many Hymn and Fuguing Tunes there are, but there are a lot. Also, very active in Cowell's struggle was a pioneer American folk song collector and activist Sidney Robertson, who had studied in Cowell's courses in the 1920s. She and Cowell would marry in 1942. Cowell on radio. In 1939, Stokowski and Granger put up the funds to win Cowell's release from San Quentin into Granger's custody. Cowell was prohibited by the terms of his release from entering New York City for a period of 12 months, during which time Cowell served as Granger's secretary. He did not do a good job of this, I can tell you from looking at the papers. He was a terrible secretary. Sorry. 1940, Cowell performed his Four Irish Tales with Fritz Mahler and the NYA Orchestra in a concert that signified his return to New York. Copies of the broadcast are held by both NYPL and the Library of Congress. I can report that this is a very powerful and moving performance, and it is the only live broadcast recording of Cowell at the piano. In 1941, he recorded the Four Irish Tales for Columbia with Leopold Stokowski and the All-American Youth Orchestra, in addition to a duet on How Old Is Song, an instrumental arrangement of Aeolian Harp with violinist Joseph Seghetti. Cowell also resumed his leadership of the New Music publication of his and of its record label, although the label ceased somewhat earlier. New Music continued until 1955, distributed to the American Music Center in New York. It folded when Cowell realized that it had achieved its objective. Many of the New Music composers had gone on to publication contracts with established concerns, and most publishers were no longer rejecting music simply based on the grounds of a difficult, discordant music style. The NYA, I don't know exactly what that stands for, NYA broadcast opened a new door for Cowell and his activities, that of radio. From 1940 until his death, Cowell collected air checks of radio performances of his own music, both those featuring himself, Sidney Cowell, and close associates such as Otto and Ethel Luning, and premieres of his works played elsewhere. Cowell collection is a treasure trove of local New York-based classical music broadcasts from the 1940s, but not to the extent that the Schillinger collection is. As Schillinger ran a proper recording studio and apparently kept copies of radio recordings that were done as client jobs. However, the Cowell collection contains such trophies as a 1947 recording of Colin McPhee's Balinese Nocturne, as played by Otto Luning, and early recordings of Cowell works, as played by regional symphony orchestras, such as those in New Orleans and Chattanooga. From about 1950, Cowell's attention in radio turned sharply towards the development of educational radio documentaries, particularly for WBAI. Though some projects were fostered to some extent through Cowell's involvement with the U.S. Information Agency and his contact with Edward R. Murrow. The most famous of these was the long-running series, Music of the World's Peoples, in which Cowell expanded the topics covered in his ethnomusicological teaching into some 40 to 70 hour-long programs. This program continued to air on Pacifica radio affiliates into the 1970s, while NYPL retains about 20 tapes relating to these programs. These are the music-only selections. They do not contain any of Cowell's commentary. Pacifica's set of the complete broadcast disappeared in the late 1970s. not totally. And while their general location is known, it will not be an easy matter to recover them. I should mention he did a This I Believe segment with Murrow that's also worth seeking out. I don't know if there's audio available, but I've read it, and it's very interesting. And I know they've revived that concept of This I Believe on NPR. The Other Minds Foundation has posted a downloadable version of Cowell's 1961 broadcast Autobiography of a Composer, originally broadcast in 1962, and of which the NYPL copy is incomplete. Cowell and Folkways. It was probably on basis of the Music of the World's Peoples broadcast that led Moses Ash to decide to contact Cowell about the time of the reorganization of his various labels into Folkways in 1951. Ash had an ability to surround himself with expert contributors to facilitate his extensive series of folk and ethnic recordings, which became the dominant player in the field so far as the domestic American market was concerned in the Cold War era. Although the man who held the desk for Ethnic Folkways during this period was Harold Courlander, Cowell's association with the Ethnic Folkways label was fruitful and led to several projects in which he enjoyed varying degrees of autonomy. Most often, Cowell was asked to contribute the track-by-track assessments of an album that he did not edit or select. And in order to get details on such projects, you almost have to go to the piece. One of Cowell's earliest Folkway albums, as both editor and annotator, was Indonesian Music, taken from film soundtracks made in Indonesia by the San Francisco documentarians Phil and Florence Walker. This was an unusual example of Cowell having the luxury of preparing an album from recordings from the same source, of consistent and uniform sound quality. One particularly fascinating Cowell project from 1955 is The World's Vocal Arts, a collection of examples of singing taken from a wide variety of Western and international vocal recordings. This album contains one of my favorite album sides from Henry Cowell, which on one side mixes up a Russian opera aria sung by Shalyapin, a blues sung by Red Willie Smith, Hebrew cantillation, and Arabic and Kurdish selections. Political compatibility of cultures was not a factor in the way Cowell compiled his collections. What he wanted to show was both the similarity and divergence in singing of widely differing cultures. It was the music, more so than the culture, that mattered. Time check. Not too bad. Cowell's best known and perhaps most influential project for Folkways was the five multi-volume sets making up the series Music of the World's Peoples. These albums were a completely different project from either the course he taught and the radio program, both bearing the same title. This was more of Henry Cowell's version of the Hornbostel demonstration collection, taking advantage of the improved technology of disc and tape over the cylinder and the wide variety of material available from his own collections, those of his colleagues and others contributed by Mo Ash. The five volumes were issued in 1952, 53, 55, 1957, and the last, and in my opinion, his opinion, best volume appearing in 1961. Following the chain of sources through the MWP series can be a difficult task. It is not always clear what they are, although different volumes approach this challenge in a different way, with some vital clues appearing on the label only. According to the Smithsonian, many of the recordings sourced through Ash were called from 16-inch Office of War information discs, which still survive at the Smithsonian today, with tracks marked off in grease pencil to identify which ones Cowell wanted to use. In my personal experience, as a kid growing up, I listened to these albums again and again, and I'm pretty sure I wasn't the only music nut who did so. They provided an excellent baseline for me to learn the ropes, if not the extent of world music, and they were widely used in teaching for decades. Today, they provide a snapshot of world music as was known on records in the 1950s, and many of the musical styles included have since disappeared owing to political or social developments and the incursion of mass media into world cultures. Here are a few of my favorites. Perhaps you will have others imagine them. Much of the writing in the NWP sets, as with all writing published under Cowell's name in his later years, was to at least some extent, and often a large extent, ghostwritten by Sidney Cowell. Definitely true. So much so that she admitted reaching a point where she really couldn't stand to do it anymore. However, the text always sound in Cowell's wry, distinctive, and impish tone, and I think it is a significant achievement for both of them as note writers to have devised a sort of corporate house style. Sidney Cowell also worked on her own as an editor for Folkways, and her preferences toward annotation, even of compilation, remain quite different from Henry's. Other criticisms have evolved over the years regarding music of the world's peoples. Many tracks are very short, some well shorter than their sources. For example, the Philippine track called Calipe in the third volume lasts only 17 seconds. Others have found Cowell's tone in his track continues too empirical, with a capital E, for their tastes. A criticism also levied his radio commentary to some degree. It's important to remember that Cowell was a generalist. To his audiences in the Ike and Mamie era, Cowell came off to the average listener as the unkindly uncle. Kindly uncle, knowledgeable on a wide range of subjects and able to make complex topics easily digestible. Cowell's final Folkways project, apart from his piano music album, Primitive Music of the World, released in 1962, seems his finest. His premise is this, quote, "In the study of the history of music, there was much speculation about what music was like thousands of years ago. Now, thanks to records, we can hear music played and sung by peoples who live now very much as their ancestors did in early times, little music cases in which various sorts of ancient musics have been preserved, at least in part in living form. We can study the history of music laterally, as it actually exists now in various stages of development, instead of speculating about what it may have been in the past." Most of the track notes are written by the original collectors themselves, with Cowell tipping in a paragraph or two for continuity's sake. While some of the tracks are still very short, otherwise, Primitive Music of the World remains a model collection of its kind. I think I am on safe ground in saying that if it weren't for collections like Cowell's, we wouldn't have had a hipper, more recent compilations like Rounder's series. Secret Museum of the World, curated by Pat Conte and Citizen Kafka, or albums such as Vergo's collection of the Patchwork Europe. Outside of Folkways, Cowell also did a little work with a Lyricord label. This 1963 LP, Music of Iran, Santor recital, bears a brace of notes from Cowell that may have been recycled from other writing. This may have been the last ethnological album to which Cowell contributed. If so, he went out on a high note. And finally, Cowell in sum. Joel Sachs has written that Dick Higgins was long a proponent of Cowell's centrality as a composer. I would agree. His work rightfully belongs to the center of the modern American repertoire, rather than off to one side. However, I submit that Cowell's achievement in terms of recordings, particularly as it relates to contemporary music and ethnomusicology, is likewise central to history of recording in general. Cowell's work, both in music and in recording, still informs us and moves art and technology forward to this day. And younger listeners in particular are strongly drawn to it, perhaps more now than ever. Henry Cowell said that he wanted to live in a whole world of music, and as far as anyone could in his time, he really did. Let's see. I don't feel right entertaining questions, although if you have any for Craig about the Haddo business, we could probably stick around for a couple minutes or so. Or not. Do we have? Okay, well, we'll adjourn. Thank you for coming.